Hey everyone, Marco Werman here. If you're listening to this podcast and looking forward to hearing the latest news, but you have not yet donated to our end of 2020 campaign, you still have time. We need only 86 more people, just 86, to raise their hands and give in the final hours of the year. Donate $100 or more to the world and you'll receive an invite to a virtual party with me and the team. You'll get to ask questions, get access to exclusive behind-the-scenes stories, and much more. We need you. Your contribution allows us here at The World to continue to bring you the original global reporting you depend on. Donate today to help keep our independent journalism free and accessible to anyone in every corner of the globe. Visit theworld.org/give to donate today. Be one of the 86 to get us there. And from every one of us here at The World, thank you. Tomorrow, voters in Georgia go to the polls, and once again, there's concern about misinformation, especially targeting Latino voters.
Things have been very strange that you don't no longer trust your source of information, and you have to go deeper.
Also today, the Trump administration touts the killing of an Iranian military commander in Iraq. But in death, controversial figures become more popular, and so it is with militia leaders in Iraq.
We used to have Saddam Hussein's portraits all over Baghdad. Now instead we have portraits of martyred militiamen or living ones, and they are everywhere.
And immigration attorneys call on Biden to live up to his election promises.
Let's take away this huge bottleneck at the border.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Glad you could join us in the first full week of the new year. We start today with news out of Iran. The Iranians are ramping up their nuclear ambitions. The one secret Fordo nuclear facility will start enriching uranium at 20%. More on that in a few minutes. Bottom line, it's a message to President Trump as well as to the incoming Biden administration. Meantime, tensions between the U.S. and Iran are high for another reason. Sunday marked 1 year since the Trump administration ordered a U.S. drone strike that killed Iran's top military commander, Qasem Soleimani, and one of his Iraqi allies, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Here's The World's Shirin Jafari.
Both Iran and the United States were sending signals to each other ahead of this anniversary.
30. All lines on post. Prepare a check complete. 20.
Cockpit sound from one of the two B-52 bombers the U.S. deployed to the Middle East last week. U.S. Central Command published this video on its Farsi language Twitter account. It also posted comments by General Frank McKenzie, the head of CENTCOM. He said the U.S. is ready to respond to any aggression. CENTCOM didn't respond to my question about what kind of aggression it's looking out for. The Iranians have been sending out their own warnings. President Hassan Rouhani said that Donald Trump committed many crimes as president. The biggest of all, he said, was to order the killing of Soleimani and Muhandis. We won't forget, Rouhani said. General Qasem Soleimani was Iran's top military commander. Experts say he was the supreme leader's right-hand man. Soleimani headed Iran's Quds Force, an elite branch of the armed forces that operates outside of the country.
This made him one of the most powerful figures in Iran and an effective commander of a transnational army of tens of thousands of people who were involved in civil wars in Iraq, Syria, and other places.
Arash Azizi is the author of a new book about Soleimani called The Shadow Commander. He says the general had humble beginnings. Born in southern Iran to a family of farmers, he went on to get a job at the water department in Kerman province. Later, he became obsessed with martial arts and took up karate. But it was the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s that propelled him to the top echelons of the Iranian military.
He rose up to become the main commander of southeastern Iran, and then he rose up the ranks in IRGC. He has spent all his life effectively in the IRGC.
The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is part of Iran's armed forces. Last January, the Trump administration touted the killing of Soleimani as a huge success. It said the general masterminded operations that led to the death of American forces in the region. But now, Soleimani has become a martyr in the eyes of the Iranian hardliners. They've named streets after him. turned his home into a museum, and there's even this rap track about him. Meanwhile, caught in the middle of this conflict between Iran and the US are the people of Iraq.
We used to have Saddam Hussein's portraits all over Baghdad. Now instead we have portraits of martyred militiamen or living ones, and they are everywhere.
Nabil Saleh is a writer and photographer in Baghdad. He was 11 years old when the US invaded his country. He says people like Soleimani are the product of the chaos that followed the US invasion.
Without this lethal state failure that we have been enduring its consequences since the invasion of 2003, none of this would have happened.
Iraqis have suffered decades of instability, Saleh says. The Americans have spent billions of dollars building up the Iraqi government and its security forces. But he says none of that has translated into a better life for Iraqis.
A few weeks ago, I visited my cousin who works in an area downtown Baghdad, and we were walking on a sidewalk, and I told him that it feels like 2006 again. And he agreed.
That was a low point for violence, Saleh says, and it's happening again. People are being killed, critics of the powerful disappear and turn up dead. As we talk, the call drops.
Yeah, I'm sorry, the power went off. Yeah, where were we?
Iraq depends on Iran for most of its electricity, and Iran recently threatened to cut the power because Iraq hasn't paid its bills. Saleh has candles nearby for when the power goes out. Marcin Al-Shamari is a postdoc fellow in Baghdad. She too says Iraqis are struggling to make ends meet.
Right now, everyone is very preoccupied with the looming economic crisis.
Iraqis have been protesting these conditions for months, Al-Shamari tells me. Security forces cracked down, killing hundreds of them. And then came the pandemic. Saleh, the writer, worries Iraqis won't fare any better even after American troops are gone. President Trump made the announcement last fall that he wants to cut the U.S. forces in Iraq to 2,500, down from 3,000.
The war hasn't ended here. It doesn't feel like it has ended because the helicopters are still roaring in the skies of Baghdad, and you still see security forces, you still see men with guns on the streets, and the road signs that are riddled with bullet holes from 2003 are still the same chaos, still the same fear.
So 1 year later, what did the US achieve by killing two top military leaders in Baghdad? Arash Azizi, the writer, says today Iran's Quds force is weaker. Its new commander, Ismail Ghani, is not Qasem Soleimani.
He does not have the same personal relationships with the Arab militias. Add this to the fact that the Iranian state has a much reduced financial capabilities right now.
Because of US sanctions, Iran is strapped for cash. It can't finance militias in Iraq the way it used to. But Azizi says, don't write off the Quds force just yet.
This was a very dangerous escalation. We are lucky it didn't erupt into a war. It could have had. Has it reduced the capabilities of Quds force? Sure it has.
But he says the Islamic Republic can still project power beyond its borders. In Washington, the incoming National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, says he doesn't think the US is safer after Soleimani's assassination. Sullivan says Joe Biden's administration plans to re-engage Iran diplomatically instead of relying on military force. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Now back to the news about Iran's nuclear ambitions. Iran's decision to start enriching more uranium is sure to set off alarm bells in the neighborhood, specifically for Israel and Saudi Arabia. Barbara Slavin is with the Atlantic Council, where she's the director of the Future of Iran Initiative. She joins us now to talk about what all this means. Barbara, Happy New Year to you. I mean, it feels like this is what Iran has been threatening to do, and now it's doing it. Why is this decision so significant, and what potential consequences could there be with this move by Tehran?
Yes, well, Happy New Year to you. Look, the Iranian parliament passed legislation demanding that the government increase the level of enrichment. This is an isotope, U-235. You need a 90% concentration to make a bomb. Iran is now moving from about 5% concentration to 20% concentration. So not quite weapons grade, but certainly on the way. So Parliament insisted that Iran do this. The government of Hassan Rouhani actually stalled for a bit. I think it's interesting that they chose to do it the day after the anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Qasem Soleimani. It's Iran's way of accomplishing several goals. First, it's saying that maximum pressure only leads to what it calls maximum resistance. In other words, the Trump administration policy has totally failed to force Iran into negotiating a better deal than the one negotiated in 2015. And it's also a way to get some leverage with the incoming Biden administration. Joe Biden has said he wants to return to the original deal and build on it. Iran is making clear that if he wants to get back into that original deal, if he wants Iran to put curbs on its program again, he's going to have to relieve the sanctions that Trump has imposed. So I think there are a variety of messages that are being sent by this. It's worrisome, but it's also reversible, like the other steps that Iran has taken on the nuclear front.
So you see it as a kind of leverage move by Tehran in advance of a possible jumpstart of new Iran nuclear talks.
Yeah, well, the first step is to get back into the old deal. The Iranians have made it very clear that they're not going to renegotiate the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. So this means Iran will go back to the restrictions under that deal. Enrichment will be kept below 5%. Stockpiles will be only 300 kilograms of low-enriched uranium. Now they have, I think, more than four times that amount. Iran will go back to that. But in return, Biden has to lift the sanctions that Trump reimposed and probably some of the new ones that he and Mike Pompeo and the Treasury Department have added.
So now that Iran's enriching uranium at 20% again, how does that change the calculus for Israel? Does it raise the likelihood that they'll attack Iran?
Well, the Israelis, you know, always say that they have that option in reserve. But where this enrichment is taking place is particularly hard to attack. It's at a place called Fordo, which is deep underground. And frankly, the Israelis are probably not capable of destroying that facility without U.S. help. And that's where we come into, you know, the last days of the Trump administration. We have seen so much disruption from President Trump on the domestic side. Is he willing to now, you know, distract from the debacle at home by starting another one overseas? I wouldn't put anything past him.
And for the incoming Biden administration, it's hard to speculate on top of other speculation. But does the president-elect have any tools he can use right now to limit potential conflagration with Iran before he comes actually into the White House?
Really, the only thing he and his people can do is through public statements. And Jake Sullivan, his incoming national security advisor, gave an interview to CNN, I believe yesterday, in which he stated the policy very clearly that the United States would like to talk to Iran about a number of issues, including its missile program. But he understands that the first step is to return to the nuclear agreement.
In other news, Barbara, the Iranians have seized a South Korean vessel. What do you know about that?
Well, this is another one of their tactics. They've made various assertions about this not being safe, that it's carrying chemicals. I'm not sure if this is true. But apparently, there is a good amount of Iranian hard currency that is frozen in South Korean banks. And this is because of U.S. sanctions. Iran would like to be able to obtain that money, in part to be able to buy COVID vaccines. So perhaps this is yet another way to try to increase Iranian leverage for sanctions relief under the Biden administration.
Barbara Slavin is the director of the Future of Iran Initiative with the Atlantic Council. Barbara, thanks very much for coming on. Good to speak with you.
You're very welcome.
2020 was the year of doom scrolling, you know, compulsively refreshing your social media feeds. But hey, a new year, a new you. The Tourism Board of Iceland wants to offer a counterpoint to doom scrolling in 2021, joy scrolling.
It's about time we scroll through joyful things instead, like 22.7 meters of soothing Icelandic streams, or majestic beams, or celestial scenes.
Iceland has created a website where you can scroll through photos of crystal blue hot springs. You can even hear some mellow Icelandic tunes.
Oh, child, how could anyone be mad at you?
That's Love Child by Júníus Meyvant. This is not the first time Iceland's tourism industry has tapped into the coronavirus zeitgeist. Last summer, the organization Promote Iceland launched a campaign called It Looks Like You Need to Let It Out. If that's not ringing any bells, this may jog your memory. The campaign encouraged people to release stress by recording screams, then uploading them so they could be played on loudspeakers throughout Iceland's countryside. I don't know, joy scrolling just feels a bit more optimistic. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The presidential vote may be over, but the fate of the U.S. Senate will be decided tomorrow in Georgia, where a special election will determine which party controls the chamber. And there is again concern about disinformation targeting the state's voters, including its growing Latino community. As part of our Every 30 Seconds series, where we've been profiling young Latino voters, WABE's Roxanne Scott reports from Atlanta.
Now that 61-year-old Eric Richner is retired, he enjoys spending time with his family in Gwinnett County, a suburb of Atlanta. And keeping up with the news, his go-tos include the BBC and the local paper.
I come from a generation that, you know, we watched the nightly news every day. It was a family gathering.
He likes knowing what people are talking about in the U.S. and in the Dominican Republic, where he has relatives. It also means checking Twitter, YouTube, and keeping up with his many WhatsApp groups. He's also stopped believing what he sees on social media and messaging groups.
In the last few years, things have been very strange that you don't no longer trust your source of information and you have to go deeper.
That lack of trust can leave an opening for misinformation to spread.
It's a claim popping up all over Twitter. Is John Ossoff in business with Communist China?
During the COVID-19 pandemic, when many businesses are struggling, a claim made against Senator David Perdue says he voted to block small business aid. Many viewers online are asking, is this true?
There's a concern that the bad information is also reaching Latino voters in Georgia ahead of tomorrow's runoffs. A recent report by Avaaz, a global civic organization, warned of 20 Facebook pages spreading misinformation about the state's elections. Two of the flag pages were in Spanish, claiming that dead people voted in the Atlanta area, and that 132,000 November ballots cast in one Georgia county were ineligible, which isn't true. Latinos make up about 5% of Georgia's electorate, far smaller than places like Florida. But with President-elect Joe Biden winning Georgia with just under 12,000 votes, the message is clear. Everyone's vote matters.
There's been a lot of money coming in to Georgia, both from the Democratic side and from the Republican side.
Tania Unsueta is a political director for Mi Gente, a national immigrant rights group. She said a lot of this information comes from political action committees and the parties themselves.
Whether it's on advertisements or whether it's the mailers that we all get at home.
She said there are many reasons Latino voters are susceptible to mis- and disinformation. One is the language barrier. Another, Unsueta said, is that political parties haven't done a great job at outreach, which can be harder in Georgia.
For people who do elections and reach out to Latinos, we're used to turf that's more dense, right? And I think people should know that sometimes we're talking about reaching 20 people in one county. And because it's people are all spread out, that takes us a whole day.
Latinos, not unlike other communities with roots elsewhere in the world, also might receive dubious information shared by relatives in other countries or through targeted campaigns.
Our elections are global. Look, the Russians are here all the time. The Chinese are here. Everybody wants something to do with the outcome of these elections. So why not the Latin Americans?
Eduardo Gamada is a political scientist at Florida International University in Miami. In terms of Latino voters, he noted how misleading information created in parts of Latin America and the Caribbean spread in the run-up to the November election through YouTube and WhatsApp. He also said talk radio is an enormous vehicle for spreading misinformation. Gamada also added that disinformation affects everyone, not just Latinos.
It plays on the real susceptibilities of people.
For Eric Richner, the retired voter who lives near Atlanta, he describes many of the ads he's seen ahead of the runoffs as mudslinging, to the point where he's struggling to find reliable information. He's already voted, but instead of tuning into ads and news to make a decision, he asked himself what vision he wanted for the country.
I actually disregarded everything in the news, everything all my friends are saying, and said, okay, I think this is the best for the country.
A decision based on his own judgment and weighing what information is real or not. For The World, I'm Roxanne Scott in Atlanta.
You remember Julian Assange. His organization WikiLeaks published U.S. government documents about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the detention center at Guantanamo Bay. The U.S. Justice Department wants to bring him to the U.S. to stand trial for espionage, But today, a British judge ruled that Julian Assange should not be extradited. Judge Vanessa Beritzer said, quote, "I find that the mental condition of Mr. Assange is such that it would be oppressive to extradite him to the United States of America." Attorney Tor Ekelund has been following the Assange trial closely. I asked him to explain the judge's ruling.
She essentially said that she thought the United States could give Assange a fair trial, but that the United States was incapable of humanely housing Assange, given the possibility that he would try to commit suicide. So she didn't indict, in a sense, the U.S. judicial system. She indicted the U.S. penal system and said, essentially, that the conditions that Assange would be kept in would be inhumane, and that she doubted the U.S. prison system's ability to keep him from killing himself.
That's kind of a stunning argument.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think it's 100% accurate. The practice in U.S. prisons quite often on putting someone on suicide watch is to strip them naked, put them in solitary confinement, which, you know, the United Nations considers to be a form of torture, and then shine lights on them for 24 hours a day while you observe them. How that's a proper treatment or attitude to somebody who's suicidal is beyond me, and that's what the court is reacting to, and it's not the first time.
Tor Ekelund, I mean, you've defended cyber activists in the past. Were you surprised by the judge's ruling this morning?
No, not really, because UK courts have already blocked extradition on these same grounds twice in hacker cases. I was ready for the court to allow the extradition and then maybe, you know, higher appellate court reverse it, like happened with Larry Love's case, which is a hacker I represented over in the UK that the US was seeking to extradite. So it's consistent with what the courts have been doing over there.
So you just alluded to the person you once represented, accused of hacking US government computers, his name, Larry Love, a British activist. When you defended him against US extradition, what was your argument?
Well, I was his U.S. counsel. He had U.K. counsel that I worked with. And I, among many others, provided evidence of the U.S. prison system's inability to house people with Mr. Love's condition. He was diagnosed with Asperger's safely and to keep them away from, well, suicide. Again, today's just another decision or a line of decisions essentially holding that the United States prison system is incapable of humanely housing people. You know, this is the magistrate's court in Westminster where courts have been sitting for almost 800 years. I mean, this is where our legal system comes from. And to get a kind of rejection of our penal system by that court, to me, is significant.
Tor Ekelund, what lies ahead for Julian Assange at this point?
The United States Department of Justice has said they were going to go to appeal, so there'll be an appeal in a higher court, but that's going to drag out for a while. That's probably another 1 to 3 years. So a lot's going to turn on what President Biden wants to have happen there.
New York-based attorney Tor Ekelund, thanks very much for speaking with us about the case of Julian Assange.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Hi, Marco Werman here, pausing the show for one of the last times this year, I promise. These final hours of 2020 are crucial for the world's fundraising campaign. We need just 86 more people to complete our goal of 1,000 donors. That's you. Yep, you, listening while you're making dinner, or over your morning coffee, or while you're cleaning the house. No matter when you listen, now is the time to act. We're incredibly grateful to each and every one of our donors, and we want to meet you. Donate $100 or more to The World today, right now, and you'll receive an invite to a virtual party with me and The World team. Visit theworld.org/give to donate today. Remember, you only have until the end of this crazy year to join. Go to theworld.org/give. And from everybody here at The World, thank you so much. Signs of life getting back to normal. In China, hairy crabs are on the menu for in-person dining.
And in China, the start of hairy crab season in the fall is as eagerly awaited as pumpkin spice lattes at Starbucks.
Also ahead, Brazilians are ignoring troubling coronavirus numbers. That's all coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We come to you from GBH Boston and PRX. For people seeking asylum in the U.S. during the Trump presidency, some key rules got changed by the White House. One obvious example, U.S. officials required tens of thousands of asylum seekers to wait out their cases in Mexico, not in the U.S. Joe Biden denounced this during a debate with President Trump in October.
That's never happened before in America. You come to the United States and you make your case that I seek asylum based on the following premise, why I deserve it under American law. They're sitting in squalor on the other side of the river.
So what might President-elect Biden do about this? The World's Monica Campbell has our story.
Acá es donde duermo con mi hija. Es un colchón inflable.
Over the phone, Imelda Lemos shows me where she sleeps with her young daughter. It's a small green pup tent, the kind you have to crouch into. They've slept in it for more than 15 months. We can see the U.S., she says. Lemos is in Matamoros, Mexico. Texas is across the Rio Grande River. She and her daughter migrated here after an armed group forced them off their land in Guatemala, she says. She hoped to find a safer life with relatives who live in New Jersey. But President Trump kept her out of the U.S. through a program known as Remain in Mexico. It forces asylum seekers to do just that, stay in Mexico until their cases are decided by a U.S. judge. The program has blocked some 65,000 asylum seekers from entering the U.S. Trump officials say it's meant to deter people from abusing immigration laws. What Imelda Lemos sees is people worn down, often by year-long waits. There are no easy days in her camp.
Ahora estamos pasando por lo que es la temporada fría.
It's cold here, she says. The water is freezing. It stings your hands. Add to this extreme heat in the summer and the smell of sewage. A lot of the people camped alongside Lemos are from Central America. They, too, are trying to escape violence and poverty. Over time, many migrants have given up and started returning home. Still, at least 20,000 asylum seekers remain all along Mexico's border. Candidate Joe Biden promised he'd end the Remain in Mexico program on day one, but President-elect Biden walked that back in December.
It will get done, and it will get done quickly, but it's not going to be able to be done on day one, lift every restriction that exists, and find out that, and go back to what it was 20 years ago, and all of a sudden find out we have a crisis on our hand that complicates what we're trying to do.
Some close observers say that Biden might be hesitant to approve any quick changes that might encourage more migrants to come. Chris Ramon is an independent U.S.-Mexico policy analyst.
Because the idea is to be able to fast-track the adjudication of these cases, does that also mean that will trigger more people coming to the U.S.-Mexico border seeking asylum?
Charlene DeCruz, an immigration lawyer in Texas, understands this, but says there's no time to wait.
Let them go to their families. Let's take away this huge bottleneck at the border. These are not people just coming in that are not recorded in the system. They've been fingerprinted. They've even gone to court several times. So allowing them in would restore some of that humanity. That is completely and entirely possible. I'm not hearing it from the Biden-Harris transition team.
DeCruz points to the dangers migrants face in Mexico: assault, rape, and kidnapping. Most migrants have relatives in the U.S. who kidnappers can call to demand a ransom payment. A few nights ago, some asylum seekers showed their frustration with the prolonged waits in Mexico. Dozens of people, many from Cuba, protested at a bridge that connects the Mexican city of Ciudad Juarez with El Paso, Texas.
Simplemente, pacíficamente, queremos esperar nuestro asilo dentro de Estados Unidos.
We simply want to request peacefully asylum from within the U.S., one Cuban man says. U.S. border officials in riot gear shut down the bridge. Imelda Lemos, living in the tent, is anxious to head north.
Todos esperamos un milagro.
We're all hoping for a miracle, she says. Her daughter hasn't gone to a real school in over a year. While we talked on the phone, though, I spotted big sheets of paper hung up near her tent. They were filled with English phrases and grammar rules.
Acá recibimos clases de inglés.
We have English classes here, she says. Lemos's daughter, Nidia, studies every day.
Every day, 2 hours.
A fellow asylum seeker is teaching the makeshift classes, sharing the English she knows. She's hoping to give people a running start when or if they're allowed into the United States. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
Brazil is grappling with its second wave of the coronavirus. Only the U.S. and India have more reported cases. Despite the dire situation in Brazil, people have been flocking to the famous beaches for one of the country's biggest tourist seasons. As Michael Fox reports from southern Brazil, that is raising concerns that the COVID situation is only going to get worse.
On New Year's Day, Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro went for a swim. In a video posted on his Facebook page, he dives into the water with several security guards from a boat just off the coast of Praia Grande, a top vacation spot in São Paulo. Supporters cheer. They're in the water in front of him, stretched out along the beach. The crowd is huge, no masks. He swims toward them. They amass around him as he arrives, chanting his nickname, Legend. It's a near-perfect metaphor for Bolsonaro's relationship with the pandemic. Blatantly disregard social distancing as cases spike. Last week, there were more than 1,000 deaths 3 days in a row. The death rate is expected to hit 200,000 this week, second only to the United States. But it hasn't dampened the holiday vacations in Brazil. Beaches have been packed. Even as some official New Year's celebrations were canceled or toned down, it hasn't stopped the parties. In this video shared over Twitter, a crowd of hundreds of partygoers dance before a huge sound system in the early dawn. All night, end-of-the-year parties and raves like this were held at beaches up and down the coast. At the more remote Açores beach on the island of Florianópolis, things are more subdued. But families still line the beach. Children play in the water. By 10 a.m., it's loaded with people. Luis de Barros and his wife arrive early to beat the crowds. Their orange umbrella is set back from the mass of people just down the beach. Luis wears a mask.
O pessoal está em restaurante, o pessoal está indo em academia, o pessoal está indo em balada, o que é uma coisa inadmissível, né?
He says people are going to restaurants, they're going to gyms and to parties, which is just unthinkable. It's controversial that we're at the beach and saying this, but we've tried to do what we can to maintain a healthy social distance so we can enjoy the sun a little without hurting others. Researchers say the forecast for the pandemic in Brazil is not good. Larissa Brusa is a biotechnologist who is finishing her PhD in genetics and molecular biology at the Federal University of Rio Grande do Sul. She says, we're seeing that in January and February, the situation is going to get worse. Deaths are going to increase. We now have a greater number of cases than what we had in August and September, which we thought had been the highest peak. People have lost their fear of the pandemic, so they're increasingly doing what they should not. Local governments have also been reluctant to mandate greater restrictions and miss out on the high tourist season. The state of Santa Catarina, where Florianópolis is located, has permitted hotels to run at full capacity, despite rising cases and legal action from state prosecutors. Brusa says the problem is that the federal government is not handing down clear direction, so the governors of each state end up having to decide alone, and often they don't make the most adequate decision. That creates confusion, and it also destroys the population's confidence in the authorities. The same confusion is playing out over coronavirus vaccines. Despite a long history leading Latin America in science and health, Brazil has yet to approve a vaccine. The federal government still has no official start date for its vaccination campaign. Some Brazilians don't want one. That's Bolsonaro ally and conservative São Paulo State Representative Douglas Garcia. He's speaking to supporters at a protest against a December Supreme Court decision mandating COVID-19 vaccines for all Brazilians. Bolsonaro has repeatedly said he would not be getting a vaccine because he already had the virus. During a recent speech, he made comical claims about the effect the vaccinations could have on the body. He said, if you turn into a crocodile, it's your problem. If women grow beards and men start to talk with high voices, the pharmaceutical companies say it's not their fault. There's nothing worse than messing with people's immunological systems. Melanie Fontes Dutra is a biochemist and one of the coordinators of the COVID-19 Analysis Network. She says Bolsonaro and other leaders are playing politics while they should be taking action. She says everyone in the world is looking for batches of vaccines from these companies that have been approved. And the longer we wait to close these agreements, the further back in the line we will end up. Some Brazilian states have pushed forward with their own vaccination plans, infuriating Bolsonaro. Sao Paulo Governor João Doria has already acquired nearly 11 million doses of the CoronaVac vaccine from the Chinese company Sinovac. The state says it plans to start vaccinating in 3 weeks, but CoronaVac has yet to be approved by the Federal Health Regulatory Agency. New Year's celebrations are over, and Carnival has been postponed in Rio de Janeiro for the first time in 100 years. But the country is just now heading into summer, and despite growing cases, lockdowns and harsh social restrictions are but a distant memory. Brazilians are likely to feel the impact in the coming months. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
Over in the UK, officials say more restrictions are coming. That's because COVID-19 infection rates are skyrocketing there. Officials trace this surge to a new, more easily transmissible variant of the coronavirus that started showing up in December. Another new variant has also been identified in South Africa. Science writer David Quammen has been tracking these new variants and just how dangerous they are. His books include Spillover, Animal Infections, and the Next Human Pandemic. Quammen says he's not surprised by the emergence of new variants of COVID-19.
First of all, to say that the coronavirus is mutating is a truism. Viruses are always mutating. Some viruses mutate faster than others and change their genomes. Coronaviruses have a high capacity to change their genomes. But when you get a cluster of mutations that seem to be spreading as a cluster through a population of hosts, then it does raise concern. And that's what's happening with this UK variant, also the South African variant. So it's not one mutation. They call it a strain or a variant because it's a cluster of mutations. And the UK variant does seem to be significantly more transmissible, but as far as they can tell so far, not more virulent.
What about the scientists who are suggesting that the virus in Southeast England may not have just mutated, but evolved, adapted to actually get around social distancing?
Yes, that is the news that is in this new paper. It just came from a group at the Imperial College London and a couple of other institutions in the UK. It is by people who really know molecular evolution of viruses, so I tend to trust it. And what they are saying is that, yes, we can confirm this variant, which they call B117, is more transmissible, significantly more transmissible. And this is the part that jumped out at me. They suggest that it might be because of the virus evolving to escape social distancing. They don't use the word evolve. They don't use the word adapt. That's my inference from what they're saying, but it's very, very interesting.
What would it take to actually prove that? And is there a danger in warning about this really troubling stuff too far in advance?
Well, there's always a danger, yes, in being too alarmist, but there's a danger in being not alarmist enough. This variant is being taken very seriously now, not just in the UK, but all over the world. That's why countries are closing their borders to travelers from the UK. And yet we know that the horse is already out of the barn. The variant has showed up in Colorado and California, in a number of European countries. So it is out there and it is probably spreading more quickly, but not necessarily causing more severe disease. And so these scientists are being very careful. They're not saying what I just said to you, which is that one could infer that perhaps social distancing is a challenge to the virus and the virus has evolved around that. That, I want to emphasize, is just a thought that occurred to me reading what they had said, that there is a correlation between social distancing and where this new variant of the virus has appeared.
To outsmart social distancing, how would the coronavirus actually do that?
The virus might, by means of good old-fashioned Darwinian natural selection, might become more transmissible, meaning that it might linger in the air a little bit longer. in rooms if it were required to do that in order to continue its chain of existence in areas where people are being careful. If people are being careful, then the virus might be selected for those mutations, those strains that allowed it to transmit better, either by higher viral load, spreading more, people shedding more virus, or the virus perhaps lingering in the air longer. Again, these are my speculations based on the very careful paper that has been published by this group from Imperial College London.
So just pulling back, David, just about a year ago, we started hearing the name of the city of Wuhan, and now we know exactly what it's all about. COVID-19 is the biggest wallop to hit the planet in our lifetimes. Last week, though, Dr. Michael Ryan, who directs the WHO's Health Emergencies Program, said this outbreak isn't necessarily the big one.
If there's one thing we need to take from this pandemic, with all of the tragedy and loss, is that we need to get our act together. We need to get ready for something that may even be more severe in future.
So, David Quammen, is the scientific community prepared for the next big pandemic? And more to the point, perhaps, is much of the globe's population ready to take the next spillover seriously?
We will see whether this horrible experience that we're having now will be an inflection point for popular understanding, appreciation of the dangers of pandemic, whether people will take it seriously, whether they will support leaders who take it seriously, whether they will support taxation that allows for preparedness, whether they will take science more seriously. I mean, that's sort of one of the underlying problems of this whole thing, is we've got people not just in the U.S., but all around the world, not just resistant to getting vaccinated, but resistant to the whole idea that science gives us objective understanding of empirical facts, that there are such a thing as absolute empirical facts, rather than everyone having their own preferred facts. So science denialism underlies that. We've got to fix that by educating our children well in science and in critical thinking early on, and turning them into better citizens than we are.
Science writer David Quammen's books include Spillover, Animal Infections, and the Next Human Pandemic. Thank you very much, David. Good to speak with you.
Thank you, Marco. Always good to talk with you.
Throughout much of China, people are back in restaurants, and just in time, because it's getting down to the tail end of the season when a prized furry crustacean shows up on menus. The World's Rebecca Canther reports from Shanghai.
That's the sound of crabs scuttling in a bucket. And they're not just any crabs. These are hairy crabs. They're called hairy crabs because of the patch of fur on their front claws. And in China, the start of hairy crab season in the fall is as eagerly awaited as pumpkin spice lattes at Starbucks. At this bustling restaurant in Shanghai's Old Town, people come from around the world to sip yellow rice wine and enjoy hairy crabs from September to December. Liu Yun has run the restaurant with his brother for the past 20 years. The flavor of the crab meat is naturally a little sweet, he says, and it leaves a fragrant smell on your hands. The most famous hairy crabs are farmed on Yangcheng Lake, an hour from Shanghai. A long row of restaurants serving hairy crab line the shore. Nearby is the Hairy Crab Mall, where crab farmers sell directly to buyers. Song Zhenghua and his wife are outside their shop, packing up shipments of live hairy crabs, 10 to a box. The crabs are small, about the size of your fist. The couple wraps each one in twine or straw to keep them from crawling away. Song says the pandemic has had an impact on business this year. Fewer people have been traveling to the lake. But he's been shipping plenty of orders to his regulars, people all over China. One courier company has even launched a special delivery service just for hairy crabs. Hairy crabs aren't just known for their flavor, but also for the prices they can pull in. This year, a box of the largest crabs could bring up to 1,800 yuan. That's about $275. Wu Quanying, another crab farmer, tells me her biggest crabs this season sold for $22 each. She says people are willing to pay top dollar for gifts or for a special meal at home. She says prices are up 10% this year, but that's because there are fewer crabs to sell. The heavy rainfall earlier this year wiped out half their yield. In the crab business, our livelihoods depend on the weather, she says. Farming and selling crabs is a tough job. The farmers harvest the crabs at night and sell them during the day. Wu and her brother work together. She says she discouraged her son from going into the family business. He's a teacher instead. Back at Liu Yun's Shanghai restaurant, diners can choose from a wide variety of hairy crab dishes, from dumplings to stir fries. But by far the most popular method, says Leo, is the simplest. There's no secret, he says. Just steam the crabs for 20 minutes. Sometimes with a little ginger or beer added to the water. Then unwrap the twine. Crack open the shell and dip the meat into a sauce of vinegar and ginger. It's a delicious and addictive ritual. And let's be honest, pretty messy. Most people order a pair of crabs, one male and one female. But for some, two is not enough. This customer, Mr. Zhou, is packing some live crabs in a plastic bag for takeaway. This is the season for hairy crabs, he says. I can eat five at a time. They're good for you, high in protein. But before you start preparing for your own hairy crab feast, be warned, you could be breaking the law. In countries like the U.S. and the U.K., hairy crabs are considered an invasive species that rides over on freight ships and damages local ecosystems. Smugglers are only adding to the problem.
3,700 of these invasive creatures are seized as they're being smuggled into Cincinnati. It is illegal to bring them into the U.S. without a permit.
Last year, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service launched Operation Hidden Mitten. They call them mitten crabs in the U.S. And by July, they'd seized nearly 15,000 of them. So, menace or delicacy? Well, living in China, I know where I stand. When hairy crab season arrives, I get in line for my chance to dig in. For The World, I'm Rebecca Kanther in Shanghai.
It is a new year, a good time to clear out your email inbox. If you want to put that off another couple of days, though, and do something else to get 2021 started right, subscribe to our newsletter, Top of the World. It'll give you a quick hit of news stories from around the globe weekday mornings so you can start the day informed. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters.
When you walk through a storm, hold your head up high.
You'll Never Walk Alone, a song popularized by a Liverpool legend, Jerry Marsden, lead singer of the British band Jerry and the Pacemakers. Ferry Cross the Mersey, another one of their biggies. Marsden died yesterday at the age of 78. From a disease, his family said, not linked to COVID-19. All kinds of tributes have been pouring in. This is Irish cellist Patrick Dexter playing his rendition of You'll Never Walk Alone. There were also spoken tributes. Sir Paul McCartney described Jerry as a mate from our early days in Liverpool. And what bigger tribute could you get than this? McCartney said Jerry and the Pacemakers were the Beatles' biggest rivals. For Jerry Marsden, the passion for music came early and never left him. So he explained in an interview on New Zealand television some years back.
As a kid of five, I knew I wanted to sing and entertain. And I still to this day want to sing. I will go on as long as the crowds are coming in and I can do it. I will sing till the end of time, because I love it. I love the people, I love the audiences. It's brilliant for me. And as long as I can, I will stay on the stage singing.
Now that he's gone, it's others who will continue to sing Jerry's signature tune, You'll Never Walk Alone, especially in Liverpool. The song became the anthem of Liverpool FC, the city's soccer heroes. Walk on with hope in your heart. The song has also become a source of inspiration over the past year to help people cope with the pandemic. In April, English singer-songwriter Marcus Mumford recorded his version, In Isolation.
Walk on through the rain, though your dreams be tossed and blown. Walk on.
And that's where we leave you on this first Monday of 2020. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston at GBH. You stay strong, be healthy, and walk on.